We learned already before that that the NSA was interested and active before the conclave. So there was some interest of the U.S. National Security Agency with regard to the papal elections, which I guess is not that surprising, perhaps.
The existence of strong pressures is not new in history. Always in the history of the Church, there were pressures. The Church and the popes have always resisted.
Hello, LifeSite friends. This episode of the John Henry Weston Show is very special. We're coming to you actually from a very special place. This is the headquarters of the Lepanto Foundation, but it is also one of the most ancient Christian communities here in Rome. In fact, directly in front of us is the church called Santa Balbina, and that is the eldest daughter of one of the ancient rulers in Rome, right, who converted their whole family. And so we've got an ancient Catholic community from like the 3rd century. So just an incredible history to this place. And on this show, we're going to be talking to Professor Roberto Dumate, who I think most of you know, but he is one of the greatest church historians alive today. And he's going to share with us both about Pope Benedict and his legacy, his history, where he stood. And you're going to want to stay tuned for this one. Professor Dumate, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's begin as we always do at the sign of the cross. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. First of all, behind us is a new beautiful statue of St. Francis. You just got that?
Yes. This is a very ancient house with many memories of the history of the church. As you say, there is the Basilica of Santa Balbina, founded under Emperor Constantine in the 14th century.
We've just experienced the funeral of Pope Benedict XVI, and now there's a lot of questions as to where we are as a church, you know, and what's going to happen, particularly in the future, a lot of worry. But tell us first about your recollections of working with Pope Benedict, first as Cardinal Ratzinger, and then Pope Benedict himself.
I have never met Pope Benedict, but I have met Cardinal Ratzinger. I remember in the year 2001, in July 2001, I was asked by Cardinal Ratzinger for a meeting, a private meeting in the Abbey of Fontgombault, the Benedictine Abbey in France. And it was a restricted number of scholars. I remember the German professor Spemann, the Spanish professor Ayuso, myself, and a few others, and some ecclesiastical people. And for 3 days, this meeting was opened and closed by Cardinal Ratzinger. The topic was liturgy. And Cardinal Ratzinger was always present and intervened with very, very interesting observations. And I understood in that meeting the importance for him of the subject of liturgy, because Cardinal Ratzinger was convinced that there is a strong crisis of the faith, and that the crisis of the faith, it is above all a crisis of the priesthood. But priests are ordered for the divine sacrifice of the Mass, and the goal of the priesthood, it is the divine worship. And so if the liturgy falls down, also the faith falls down, and for Cardinal Ratzinger, it was very important a restoration of the liturgy. So when in July 2007 there was Benedict XVI promulgated the Motu Proprio Summorum Pontificum, I was not surprised, because it was absolutely coherent with his mind. And in my view, this motu proprio, summorum pontifico, is perhaps the highest, the pivotal point of his pontificate.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's really fascinating about this is that I think a lot of people perhaps assumed Pope Benedict had some kind of conversion, particularly those maybe who would have read your book on the Second Vatican Council, because it comes out that Pope Benedict, as Father Ratzinger and Cardinal Ratzinger later, but he was a pivotal figure in the Second Vatican Council who was one of the ones primarily responsible even for getting rid of the schema, the old documents that were prepared, that were excellent for the Second Vatican Council, thrown out, and then they come back with very, as you note in your book, ambiguous kind of documents, which now have greatly harmed the church because they were made ambiguous and allowed all sorts of confusion because of the documents of Vatican II being so ambiguous. So if you could comment on that.
Yes, you are right, but perhaps it is too much to speak of a conversion. Of course, there was a change in his attitude, because, as you said, he was not a cardinal, but the young theologian, Joseph Ratzinger, who assisted the Cardinal Frings, was among the more engaged theologians, progressive theologians in Vatican II. With Karl Rahner, Henri de Lubac, and others, and so he gave an important contribution to Vatican II, but something changed after Vatican II. I mean that there was a fracture, a division. Inside the progressive front between a more radical wing and a more moderate wing. And so the more radical theologians were Karl Rahner, Yves-Marie Chenu, Schillebecs, and others. On the opposite side, there were Joseph Ratzinger, Hans Urs von Balthasar, Henri de Lubac. These last theologians, founded the review Communio, which was opposite to the progressive review Concilium. And the theologians of Concilium followed the so-called school of Bologna of Giuseppe Alberigo. And for them, the Vatican II had to be a revolution inside the church. On the contrary, for Joseph Ratzinger and the other theologians of Communio, they interpreted Vatican II in continuity with the tradition of the Church. And so there was the birth of the so-called hermeneutic of continuity. And of course, Cardinal Ratzinger was the more prominent representative of this new theology, the hermeneutic of continuity. And when he became a prefect of the Congregation of the Faith, we have to remind that he was the author of the new Catechism of the Church. The Catechism is signed by John Paul II, but the real author, we know, is Cardinal Ratzinger. And he was also the author of this report on the faith with interview with Vittorio Messori, which is also very important because it gives the idea. We remember also during his period as prefect of the Congregation of the Faith, the condemnation of the theology of the liberation and many other things. So he was accused to be a traitor, a betrayer by the more progressive representative of the Bologna's school. But in fact, there was a certain coherence in his attitude. So perhaps more than a conversion, I would speak of a development of this position.
One of the things that is interesting, so these are controversial positions that Father Ratzinger had, Cardinal Ratzinger had, because they did away, one of the very stark changes was the doing away of anathemas, doing away of condemnations of people. And Father Ratzinger and Cardinal Ratzinger was very, even as Pope, very, I don't know the right word, but generous or willing to speak to real heretics, real people who were damaging souls in the church by their infidelity to Christ and his teachings. But he nevertheless dialogued with them and didn't condemn them. But I think some of that attitude might have also led to Pope Benedict's downfall, because he needed to act, for instance, with regard to Tarcisio Bertone, who was very unsupportive, but was supposed to, the Curia were around the Pope, supposed to be protecting the Pope, but it really did seem like, no, the Pope was called to protect them instead. And so do you see perhaps in that attitude something of the former Ratzinger, who wasn't willing to do the anathemas anymore and thought that's the wrong way for the church, leading to his eventual kind of downfall?
The crisis of the end of the beginning of our century, when Pope Benedict became Pope, was a deeper crisis than the modernist crisis of a century ago. But St. Pius X faced the modernism, above all with the precious help of his Secretary of State, Cardinal Merry del Val, who was an anti-modernist as the Pope, as St. Pius X. They were not only anti-modernist both, but they were really holy men. And they faced modernism with governing. I mean, not only with an intellectual attitude expressed, for example, by the encyclical Pascendi, by intervening directly in the seminaries, in the universities, condemning books, heresies, errors. This, unfortunately, didn't happen with Pope Benedict. I think that perhaps the main limit of his life, it is that he was always a professor. I am a professor, and so I can understand this. I think that also when he took the title of Pope Emeritus, he had in mind the fact that in the universities, professors at the end of their career become professor emeritus professor. This means that a professor is always a professor, also when he is retired. But it is not the same thing for a Pope. But this is another point. Returning to Benedict, he was a professor in the sense that he liked to have an intellectual confrontation. For example, he received after his election Hans Küng. Hans Küng, in my view, is one of the worst heretics of the last century. I don't think that, for example, Pius X would had never met, I don't know, Tyrrell or Loisy or Buonaiuti, for giving the name of some famous modernist, for meeting them for an intellectual discussion. So this is the problem, because we have to remember that the Pope is the man who governs the Church. The Pope is above all governor. And Pope Benedict was a great intellectual. When he was Pope, he wrote books, interesting, good books. I remember three books on Jesus Christ, very, 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 very fascinating books. But I don't think that the mission of a Pope it is to write private books like an intellectual. It is more than this. It is to condemn people who deny the orthodox truth about the topics of these books. And so this is the main limit, in my view, of Benedict XVI, of not only of Benedict XVI as a pope, but also of Cardinal Ratzinger as a prefect of the Congregation of the Faith.
One of the things you mentioned about the resignation of Pope Benedict, even though I think a lot of people are going to talk for the next centuries about Summorum Pontificum, as you said, being the highlight of his papacy, there's also another thing, because the resignation itself is such a stark thing. It hadn't been done in 700 years. And you have this, and then you have this new strange idea of a Pope Emeritus. Now, when John Paul II came to Canada, he famously went to Conrad Black's place, and there he said, there's no such thing as a Pope Emeritus. And that was very well understood, and it lived out in John Paul's life. Pope John Paul, we watched him suffer and die in the seat. A lot of people think that perhaps because Benedict watched John Paul die like that and had to act to support him in that role of Pope while he was dying, that maybe that encouraged his resignation. What are your thoughts on this new thing that Benedict has done with the Pope Emeritus, staying in white and still giving an apostolic blessing? And at the same time, the whole notion of this, you know, resignation and perhaps setting a precedent for the future.
Just a quick note before we return. If you would like to stay up to date on LifeSite's coverage of the latest life, family, and culture news, subscribe to one of our many newsletters by going to lifesitenews.com/subscribe. And if you'd like to help us bring our truth-telling coverage to millions around the world, please consider making a one-time or monthly donation at give.lifesitenews.com. And now, back to the video.
I think that if the highest point of his pontificate is perhaps the Summorum Pontificum. I have seen that either Cardinal Burke and Monsignor Schneider has said this, and I share their idea on this point. The darkest point of his pontificate, in my view, is the resignation from the papacy. There are two different point. The first, it is the fact itself of the resignation, because until today are inexplicable the real reasons of this resignation. Because, of course, in the history of the Church, there were popes who abdicated, few popes. But in all the different cases, there was always a real important reason. And until today, it's not so clear what is the real reason, because many people think that perhaps there were strong pressures on him, blackmail. Cardinal Ratzinger, but also Monsignor Genswein in a recent interview, and I think in his recent book, said that no, that this was not the problem. Cardinal Ratzinger, when something spoke about a blackmail, saying it is a nonsense. If someone would have pushed me, obliged me to abdicate, I would have resisted. So this is really very, very obscure, because it seems that the only reason it is that Pope Benedict was very tired. It seems that he was convinced that to live no more than 1 year. He lived 10 years more, but he has been the longest lived Pope of the history, with 95 years, because I think that after him there is only Leo the 13th with 93 years. So the post pontificate is longer than the pontificate, because the pontificate of Benedict, it is a pontificate of 8 years and 10 years of post pontificate. But this is only one point. There is the other point, which is the fact that when Pope Benedict announced his abdication, all the people was presumed that he went in a monastery without participating to the life of the church. But in fact, what happened is that he assumed the title of Pope Emeritus. He dressed in white. He gave the apostolic benediction. And so the common people had the idea of two popes, Benedict and Francis. But a diarchy, it is impossible in the Catholic Church, because Jesus Christ is only a vicar, and all this vicar is Francis or is Benedict. And what happened, unfortunately, it is that some people is today convinced that the true Pope was not Francis but Benedict, and this is a problem. There is a confusion, unfortunately, created by Benedict himself, assuming the title of Pope Emeritus.
Yeah, so that's a difficult question, because there's a lot of discussion about what that meant anyway. Could he do it if there was pressure, if there was no pressure? It's coming out now that there were pressures that we didn't know about. This General Laporta mentions how the a member of the NSA, the National Security Agency in the United States, had said after the 2005 election that we will make him retire soon. And there's actually corroborating evidence for that, because we learned already before that the NSA was interested and active before the conclave. So there was some interest of the U.S. National Security Agency with regard to the papal elections, which I guess is not that surprising, perhaps. But nonetheless, there were these pressures. Some, obviously, there was the San Gallen Mafia, who was working against Benedict, as we know from Cardinal Daniels himself. So there were all these pressures. So people then wondered about the resignation. Then we had these huge theories about this strangeness of the resignation itself, because there was a talk about Munus being resigned, and even Pope Benedict or Genswein talked about some kind of bifurcation of the papacy that is a new thing, and how this is now, and somehow he retained some kind of spiritual papacy or something. But this is now another thing in the church that we have to deal with in the future. And what does that even mean?
The existence of strong pressures is not new in history. Always in the history of the church, there were pressures. For example, at the end of the 18th century, there was a strong pressure on for electing a pope for destroying the Jesuits. And in fact, the pope who was elected, Clement the 14th, dissolved the Jesuit order. But we can remember also the conclave of 1903, at after the death of Leo the 13th, so when was elected St. Paul the 10th. In that conclave, inside the conclave, a cardinal, Cardinal Puzina, declared officially the veto, I mean the prohibition on behalf of the Emperor Francis Joseph for electing a Pope, Cardinal Rampolla. So, and we can quote hundreds of examples of this strong political pressures from France, Spain, Germany, the Church and the Popes. Have always resisted. For example, after the veto of Francis Joseph, Pius X suppressed any kind of veto in the conclave. And so we can imagine, of course, the existence of plots, plans for intervening in the conclave. But I think that what had to be the attitude, the right attitude of a pope at this moment, to denounce this publicly, to say, for example, I am obliged to abdicate for having for the pressures. But on the contrary, this is always denied these pressures. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that he was a liar. Why there is this, there are all this theory about this the pressures? Because I can understand that it seems very strange that without any pressures he could abdicate. But I fear that this is the historical reality, that he retired, he dismissed because he was very tired, because he couldn't in my view the perhaps a deep reason of his abdication, it is the failure of the hermeneutic of continuity. Benedict XVI, during his pontificate, faced the crisis of the faith, and he thought that with the weapons of the hermeneutic of the continuity, he could perhaps resist fight against this crisis. But unfortunately, what's happened, it is that during his pontificate, the processes of auto-demolition of the church continued. What I want to say, it is that the hermeneutic of the continuity couldn't stop the process of the auto-demolition of the church, and this because we cannot stop an historical process led by theologians, pastors, and politicians and other people, only on the plan of an hermeneutic debate. Our weapons must be different, of course, above all the weapons of the prayer, but also if you are a pope, the weapons of condemning or anathematizing. And I think that, unfortunately, this missed in the pontificate of Pope Benedict. And perhaps this was one of the reasons of his abdication.
That's very, very interesting, because we do see papal condemnations, anathemizings, and cancellations now in the papacy of Francis. We see some very radical moves, first with Cardinal Burke out, Piacenza out, even Sarah, who you'd think, because he was an African cardinal, there's no way, how in the world, but it doesn't matter, out. All good men, but nonetheless, condemned and out. And then, I mean, for America, it's very radical, because at the same time as you watched Father Rupnik here,
yes,
scandalous, guilty of sexually abusing nuns and then confessing them in the confessional, excommunicated and then resuscitated by Francis, still a priest. Yet in America, the best known pro-life priest, Father Pavone, is laicized. So it's brutal for America. But we're seeing, yes, a pope who is doing what needs to be done, perhaps, but in the opposite direction.
Yes, you are right. I agree with you. I mean, I think that there is an abuse of authority with Pope Francis. But on the other side, with Pope Benedict, there is a lack of authority. So the Pope is a sovereign. The Pope is someone who governs the Church. Pope Francis governs the Church, but unfortunately, not only he governs sometimes in an unjust way, but it is not only someone who exercises authority, which is good, but it is authoritarian, like a dictator. So, you know, there is a book, The Dictator Pope. But in the history of the Church, the Pope has never been a dictator. He has been a man who has governed the Church with a stronger authority. I think that perhaps the first thing that of course, the first thing that the good Catholic, traditional Catholic, wish, desire for the future, it is a Pope who restore the good doctrine, the truth inside the Church. This is the main desire for traditional people. But I think that if we consider not only traditional, but all the Catholic people, including progressive, I think that in this moment, what all they really would like in a future conclave, it would be a right pope, in the sense a pope who exercises justice. Because the perhaps one of the problems today in the Church, it is the lack of justice, and this also the progressive feel this. They don't feel themselves sure because the Pope in this moment, the behavior of Pope Francis is more similar to a behavior of a dictator than to a behavior of a traditional pope. This is a serious problem.
Unbelievable. So much there. If you had to give us a one-word answer, how much longer do you think Pope Francis will be reigning as pope?
I don't think very much for two reasons. The first is that he seems to be very ill. But of course, I'm not sure about this. But here in Rome, there is a strong voice about his health. The health of Pope Francis is very bad. But this is a physical reason. There is a more intellectual or theological reason. It is the fact that his pontificate is leaving a very rapid decline. I mean that he... also, Pope Francis is aware that the pontificate, his pontificate, it is at the end. Some years ago, I wrote an article with the title "Motus in fine velocior," which means that movement becomes more rapid. At the end, and this is my impression. In this year 2023, the things will go very rapidly, and the pontificate will go to his end.
There is so much more we could talk about, but we've got to wrap it up now. Professor DeMatte, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
God bless you.
Thank you very much.
And God bless all of you. And we'll see you next time from Rome.
Hi everyone, this is John Henry Weston. We hope you enjoyed this video, and to see more like this, be sure to hit the subscribe button below to get all the latest content from LifeSite News. So check out our links in the description to read more, sign up for our newsletter, and connect with us on social media so that you can stay up to date with all of the latest life, family, and culture news. Thanks for watching, and may God bless you.